lasso. So we return to the close application of mindfulness to mental feelings. And as always, the shamatha is something like a baseline, like a base camp, a place you can rest, a place you can have kind of a comfort zone, a place to come back to, something that's constant. So I've introduced the settling the mind in its natural state as your baseline for attending to feelings arising in the mind. But bear in mind, when the Buddha was teaching his great discourse on the four applications of mindfulness, he made no reference to settling the mind in its natural state. He taught just one shamatha method, and that's mindfulness of breathing. Right? So I know, having met with all of you now, all of you at one point or another, individually, you're all, of course, unique, and some of you just naturally are more inclined to and feel more comfortable and more adept at mindfulness of breathing. And others just naturally take to settling the mind and really enjoy it, and you know, you can succeed in it. So what I'd like to do for this coming session is for me to give fewer words, give you a bit more freedom to find your own niche, your own approach. And so I won't give much this time, but what I would suggest is, in terms of your shamatha, just go with whatever just feels most effective for you, whether it's mindfulness of breathing or settling the mind. And then you have that as your base, something that, and if you're settling the mind, what I would suggest is that your base, something that is kind of fairly constant, is that field, that space of the mind. There it is, at least as a backdrop, as in the conversation with Birgit earlier, at least that space is always there. And then for most of it, there are bound to be thoughts, images arising, at least periodically, and they're not that hard to attend to ascertain. So there you are, and so as you're attending to that space, and when they come up, when you attend to, you notice the thoughts, images, and so forth arising. There's kind of your constant, your focus, and within that, or relevant to, relative to that, then of course take note of feelings arising, especially psychological, but that whole interface, that intertwining of feelings in the body as well as feelings in the mind. But is that clear then? You kind of have your base within the shamatha, attending to the space of the mind, its contents. And with that, and then now and again, you'll be specially noting a feeling coming up, maybe triggered. And this is where we go into Vipassana. Triggered by what? Well, as in the conversation with Steph yesterday or earlier, sometimes you may not be able to tell, just the feelings coming up. But other kinds you can. It's a memory that was happy or disturbing. It was maybe a sound. Maybe it's, you know, there's construction noise, there's buzzsaws, chainsaws over there, and so that could trigger some, when are they going to stop? You know, a little bit of unpleasant feeling could arise in the mind. Triggered by sound. It could be triggered by sensations in the body. So look at the cooperative conditions. The sound doesn't turn into a feeling. Tactile sensations don't. Thoughts don't turn into feelings, right? But those can all act as cooperative conditions to catalyze or trigger pleasant, unpleasant, or for that matter, neutral feelings. So watch the process of origination, and then how they are present, your core Vipassana questions, impermanent nature of dukkha, anatman, non-self, and then how they dissolve, because feelings don't just linger on forever. And one other point there, I think of interest, I know from my long friendship now, it's 12-year friendship with Paul Ekman, and he makes a distinction, I'll give very briefly the overall distinction, emotions, and of course that includes happy, sad, but it's broader than that. But emotions, as by nature and by definition, being fairly brief, that's how psychologists use the word, emotions, fairly brief. That situation may be really unhappy, but I got over it. And then a mood, so emotions may be seconds or minutes. Moods can be many minutes or even hours. All afternoon I felt kind of in a bad mood, or I was just feeling really euphoric all afternoon, or whatever. But it lingers. So we have emotions, quite transient. Moods can really last for hours on end. And then we have temperament. Temperament. And have you ever met a gloomy person? I've met a cheerful person, and I don't mind saying what her name is. Her name was Thubten Chodron. Her name is Thubten Chodron, another Thubten Chodron. Chodron-la. I've known her since we were like 13 years old. It's very unusual from the same town. And she went off and became a nun, and what was it, the late 1970s, we kind of connected again. Oh, fancy that, you know? So we've known each other for decades. Well, back then, and I'm going to reveal one of her secrets. Her name is Cheryl Green, and she went by the name of Cherry. Cherry. So take that, Drukten Chodron. She's known as Charity. And she, you know, when I knew her in middle school and through high school, she was just one of those people who's cheerful. Just that was her nature. She was just a cheerful person. And what can you do with a name like Cherry? You know, like, my name's Cherry, how are you? You know, it really wouldn't work. So you kind of have to rise to the occasion. Like a girl named Peaches. It doesn't happen often, but you know, how could you be really a sourpuss? And hi, my name's Peaches. In any case, she was called Cherry. So she's one of the people I've known that just by temperament, she is very cheerful. And I've met her over the decades since then. She is. She has a cheerful disposition. And that was before practicing Dharma. In other words, she practiced Dharma in the last life. So there it is. So we have a wide variety of temperaments. Now let's cut back to it. But we see emotions, minutes. Moods, maybe hours. Temperament can be decades. Open question for the psychologist whether temperament can be changed. To my mind, it's open and shut. I already know an answer I'm convinced is true. Temperament can be changed. Temperament can be changed. But of course, it takes a lot of work. Or a life-transforming event. That can do it too. Something really big can come into your life and just set you on a whole new course. So you can imagine that. A person's cheerful until a dear loved one dies, or your only child dies, or some other tragedy, and then gloomy, gloomy, gloomy for the rest of the life. That can happen for sure. And if it can go down, then there's always symmetry here, then why not up? Well, what I'm getting at here is that as we're attending now to the simple emotions, happy and sad, emotions arising, you may be able to see the cooperative conditions that catalyze it here, trigger it there. But if you see a mood setting in, and that could happen over the next, by the way, we only have 6 weeks left. Over the next 6 weeks, it could happen that you slip into a mood. Could happen. You'll certainly have emotions. But you may have a mood as well. Now, Paul Ekman says, he's a very, very savvy affective psychologist, he said, I would be happy never to have a mood again. I'd like to have continue to have a rich array of emotions, part of being human, but I could do without moods. I would really be happy to have no moods, because they get you stuck in a cognitive bias, and that refractory periods and all of that. He said, I would be happy, of course, you can't just choose not to have moods, but it's an interesting perspective. What I'm getting to is this, and then we'll go back to the meditation, and that is when you see a mood sets in, just by the very nature of it, the fact that it's lingering for maybe hours on end, suggests that it's the trigger is not something that's happening momentarily from the environment. Because the environment's changing, right? Probably not. If a mood sets in, that which is perpetuating it, here's a hypothesis, is almost certainly grasping. Because bear in mind, when we superimpose upon experience my impression of another person, my impression of the Tanyapura Mind Center, my impression of the Republican Party, whatever it may be, our impressions, our ideas tend to be static, relatively static. Mine hasn't changed much for at least throughout the whole Bush era. You know. Republicans are, you know, they're icemen. They're just frozen into blocks of ice. In my mind, I mean, especially the right wing, they're frozen. Are they really? No, but in my mind, they're just locked in. They're like Neanderthals. Tax cut, you know. Always the same thing. I mean, it's like a broken record. And I'm telling you my own delusional mentality of just locked into a frozen attitude that I superimpose upon millions of people, which is probably not very realistic. Or it might be, but... But the point is, whether it's a political party or a country, a government, a person, a place, and so forth, that which we superimpose tends to be static. And by clinging to that idea, that attitude, and so forth, by clinging to it, now when we say clinging to it, we know we're dealing with something real, has causal efficacy, right? By clinging to it in that kind of holding pattern, some static pattern, that's, I suspect, is what sustains an emotion, and it goes into the holding pattern of a mood. Held with grasping. Held with the superimposition of something relatively static that is superimposed upon actual reality, which is always fizzing, always effervescent, always in flux. So if you've gotten locked into a mood, you might want to see who's doing it. It's probably not anybody else doing it to you. It's probably self-generated. my hypothesis, and it's not a metaphysical one, it's one you can test. See if you get caught in a mood, whether it's not because you've superimposed on reality something relatively static, and then holding on to that, fusing that with reality, and thereby perpetuating a certain emotion and having it bleed over into a mood, and very possibly not to your benefit, not to your advantage. Okay? So, I've given a fairly long preamble. So now there'll be relatively few words in the meditation itself, just a little few little punctuation marks here and there. So either mindfulness of breathing as your base, your shamatha base, settling the mind as your base, so there's something constant, and then within that, then look for these fluctuations from the base, and that is these uprisings, almost like solar flares, you know, a flaring up, an emergence of some feeling, somatic or psychological, either one. Watch them rise up, watch the factors of origination, what triggers them and so forth, watch how they are present, watch how they dissolve. Okay, 24 minutes. Find a comfortable position if you like. Settle your body, speech, and mind in the natural state. And at any time throughout the session, if you find yourself just wandering off, getting a bit sloppy, you can always come back and just count a few breaths, maybe count 10 breaths. Stabilize, get yourself grounded again, and then venture back into the practice either shamatha or on the basis of shamatha, Vipassana. continuing in either the mindfulness of breathing or the settling the mind in its natural state. Find your meditative object, then practice as explained earlier. In that ongoing flow of experience, take special note of or closely apply mindfulness to the emergence of emotions, as well as the flow of just a neutral emotion or feeling. Let's continue practicing now in silence. Oh, yeah? So what I'd like to do, as I did yesterday, is go back and forth between the written questions and open to live questions. So here's the first written one. As I'm going along on this along this meditation journey, I'm finding that the more introspective silence inward I go, I feel more anxiety, social anxiety, arising. For example, because I'm more attentive to what's coming up inside me now, there's a sense of unease when interacting with others. I'm simultaneously monitoring myself and my reactions. Interactions don't feel natural anymore. I find it difficult to adjust, to just be present with someone and not have the introspection we've been training keep interrupting. So, a very good question, very good comment, observation. So, yeah, so I think this is relevant to more person than one. That's why I'm quite happy to read it publicly. Certainly, it's true. And that is when we're just single-pointedly focused on another person and just being spontaneous. Isn't that a nice word? Just be spontaneous. Except that it's not. That is, sometimes it is, and then sometimes spontaneously we're just erupting with rubbish from our mouths and saying things we regret and doing things that were just awful, and that just happened by us being spontaneous. And so spontaneity, of course, it cuts both ways. To some of the most catastrophic events of our lives, we just acted on impulse, and it was very spontaneous, and it was catastrophic. And other times, it's humor, it's creativity, it's joyful, it's light, it's playful, and maybe very constructive as well. So there it goes, spontaneous. So we don't want to lose that. That we're being so disciplined, we're locked in. You know, obviously that's an extreme. It's the extreme of being too rigid, right? And on the other hand, unless you're an arhat or a Buddha, if you're an arhat or a Buddha, be spontaneous at all times. Whatever impulse comes up, just let it flow. Because your mind's free of mental afflictions, so whatever comes up is going to be fine. In other words, you're completely free. Because all your choices will be wise, because they will not be modified, contaminated by mental afflictions. So very, very cool. Until you're an arhat or a Buddha, you might want to not go totally spontaneous, because other stuff can come up, right? And the more psychotic you are, you probably want to show a lot of restraint. You know? So there we are, waffling around. I feel like an ice skater myself. You know, ice skating towards enlightenment, and then ice skating towards psychosis, and a bit more, and then weaving off into mild neurosis and off to benevolence, and then you know, just la-da-da-dee-dee, swooping all over the place, you know? And then there we are, and that's life, that we're kind of dancing our way forward and backwards and hopefully making more forward than backward. But a lot of fluctuation, right? So what to do then? First point here, because this is a very practical question, it needs a very practical answer, and it's from Steph. You know, the shamatha. We're going to come back to the same old, same old. And that is, the more relaxed you are in your skin, the more relaxed you are in your mind, having just at ease, not worrying, And out of this, that sense of ease, comfort in your own skin, comfort in your own mind, out of that actually grows confidence. That I feel this when I do a lot of public speaking, not just to a small group, but you know, sometimes in large conferences and so forth. You know, I never feel nervous. I really never do. It doesn't matter how many people. Translating, that's a bit difficult, because I want to make sure I translate somebody else's words correctly. So I have been nervous there. Public speaking, I can't remember the last time I was nervous. Because I figured, look, I'm going to offer my best. If you don't like it, whatever. That's it. I'm just going to offer my best. And if you like it, you like it. If it's beneficial, beneficial. If it's not, well, I still offered my best. So I'm not going to be anxious here, because I have no control over what you think about what I say, whether you practice well. I have no control at all, so why should I be anxious? You know? And so it comes from confidence that I know what I'm talking about, that I'm passing on a lineage of teachings, really doing my best not to distort it. And so I feel very much at ease in that regard. Now, I have many, many faults, but when I'm doing public speaking, that's not one of them. And of course, could my public speaking be contaminated by mental afflictions? The answer is yes. And that's when I have my regrettable episodes, right? But I do my best for that not to happen. And overall, I think it's okay. So, but I'm giving that as one example. Is even if I'm speaking before, you know, like I will, again, probably 3,000 people when I go to Sydney late October. I'll give a public address before 3,000 people. I'm not going to be nervous. I'm going to talk about something I feel confident about. I know it's good. I already know it. If 3,000 people disagree, that's their problem. I already know it's good. And they're not going to persuade me. You know, what's 3,000 people versus 2,500 years of arhats? We just outvoted you, sorry. So, but that's what I'm getting at. It's kind of an ease of kind of a contentment, an ease that I know that what I'm offering is good. I'm offering it without distortion. That's as good as I can do. And if none of you get any benefit, well, okay, I did my best. I'm going home. And don't invite me back. It's real easy. Don't invite me back. If I wasn't a benefit, there's no reason to have me back. So, I mean, I'm just telling you straight from my heart. That's how I speak publicly. And I'm not at ease in every single situation, but I accept invitations because I feel I can speak with ease. Right? So, but I'm using that as an example that can have a lot of applicability elsewhere. If you're cultivating that sense of ease, that relaxation, that looseness in your body, then that's your ground state. That's your earth, right? And on the basis of that, if you have also that kind of composure, an inner calm, a composure, a collectedness, so that when you're attending to someone, you really are giving them your full attention, which means you're giving them, you know, potentially you're really giving them your best. If there's clarity on top of that, that really just undermines social anxiety. So a lot of people, when giving public speaking, they feel a lot of social anxiety, right? Well, I don't, for that reason. Now, if I play piano in public, then I feel social anxiety because I don't play very well. So, and even at my best, I didn't play very well. And so there's that ground. It comes back to shamatha. Right? And then, on top of that, as we introduce the vipassana, then as we, in mindfulness, there's a cost-benefit analysis by bringing in the introspection because it does break the flow, right? But hopefully there's more benefit than the disruption of the continuity because then you won't wander off for minutes at a time because you are monitoring, checking in. Well, similarly in our social interactions, as we are engaging with the other, well, certainly for starters, there's no jarring, there's no contamination, there's no interruption by giving another person visually our full attention, attending to their physical presence. You know, like that, well, that's not a problem. And then by attending closely, especially to the face, we can pick up happy, sad, emotions, anxiety, fear, surprise, and so forth. And that's not an interruption. And also then we can see what's the motivation. Motivation. Now, if I were a salesman, I'm sure there are other occupations where I'm going to try to get inside you because I want your money, I want to manipulate you, I want to get you to do something that I want you to do. So now how deep can I get my tendrils of my insight into you so I can get you to do just what I want? So I think the advertising business is exactly designed to do that. To try to get inside us and find the hook to say, oh yeah, I need that. Oh, I want that. It's all manipulation, of course. It's an I-it relationship. I think advertising, by definition, is kind of I-it. Pretty much. I don't think it's generally a benevolent industry. Could be. Often not. But so as we're simply attending to, but with a benevolent motivation, why would I want to attend to you very closely? So I can serve you better, be a better friend. It's kind of simple. But if I'm more present with how you are right now, my responses, my way of engaging with you can hopefully be more helpful. So simple. Actually, that's the end of it. Right there. Is that so simple? So simple. So there's no anxiety, once again. So I think if you kind of come back to that base in shamatha, and then it's also just getting used to it. When we try something new, then often that's a bit jarring, a bit unsettling, and send us a little bit ill at ease, and I think you and I have the conversation of learning stick shift. I think you said you hadn't, right? Well, when you first learn it, I mean, it just drove me up the wall. It was so anxious. Am I doing everything right? I mean, I ruined my dad's car and so forth. And so it's very anxious. And then once you get the hang of it, it's not anxious anymore. So it's kind of similar with vipassana. Just get into the flow of it, and say, but this is really quite natural. This is just kind of turning on the light bulb to a higher wattage in your life, so that you're just generally more present. But now, final point, because it's a very juicy question, and that is this close application of mindfulness. As soon as we say that, because that's temba nyewar shapa. It's a very direct translation. Close application of mindfulness. Well, what does that necessarily entail? If I'm closely applying my mindfulness to gache, for example, really attending closely, then what does that entail? It means vividness is going to come up. Because clarity, vividness, which means high resolution, I'm going to be very sensitive to even, you know, fluctuations of her mouth. Does she smile? Does she keep, you know, I'll be very attentive, right? Very attentive. Now, in other words, that's vividness. Now, whether it's in shamatha, whether it's in vipassana, or anything else, if you have a high degree of vividness, and now do you know what I'm going to say? And you don't have the stability underneath that, and you don't have the relaxation under that, that high degree of vividness is going to make you hypersensitive, and therefore fragile, and therefore easily freaking out. You know, why did the right side of her mouth go down right then? So there we are. So as for shamatha, so for vipassana. Base in relaxation, keep on coming back there. The worst side of it is you'll take a nap. That's the worst scenario. If you overdo it on relaxation, you get a nap. You could do worse. And then you got stability. You could be boring. If all you have is stability and no vividness, just kind of like, always calm. So again, not a big downside. So you're boring, big deal. People will forget it. They'll forget you and it both at the same time. So have that base, relaxation, stability, and then vividness. Then really it all works out. And I would say this with great confidence, like a pyramid, the broader your base of your relaxation, then you can have any amount of stability. And if you have that base of relaxation stability, you can have any amount. I think it's impossible to have too much clarity. Otherwise, the Buddhas would have to have a limit. Oh, can't go that high, you know. So there's no such thing as too much clarity, in principle. There's too much clarity if you don't have enough stability and relaxation under it. So if we keep on working like a pyramid from the bottom up, then you can keep on just going higher and higher and higher. I mean, incredibly vivid. And that goes for both temporal and qualitative vividness, like what Paul Ekman trains his students, his postdocs and so forth to do, to recognize these micro expressions that flit across the face in 50 milliseconds, 30 milliseconds. He trains people to do that. He trains policemen. He trains the, Transportation Security Agency at Customs and all of that. He trains these people to recognize these micro expressions of people as they're going through to see, you know, any suspicious characters there. It's something's done. So that's the answer, okay? Yeah, that should really solve the problem from the ground up, okay? Good. What's up coming from you all live? We'll start with Graham.
My question is quite similar to that last written question, only I'm specifically referring to the practice of resting in the basic space of the mind, which I feel for me is quite easy to do when I'm sitting on my cushion or lying in Shavasana or even walking down a long, empty corridor.
Right.
However, my question is, how do you actually embody the practice or, you know, kind of live it? Because it seems to me that if I want to interact with another person or even just the space around me, by necessity, I must, you know, when I'm on my cushion and I'm resting in the space, the basic space of my mind, there are, you know, a myriad of possibilities being presented to me at any one moment.
Yeah.
However, if I want to interact with someone, I must, you know, almost out of necessity, choose one possibility and go with that. And that seems to, or from my understanding or my observation of my mind, that excludes everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, and I have a sense that in order to live the practice, then one must become kind of adept at very quickly choosing something and then, again, withdrawing back to the space of the mind. And then, again, when the response comes from the environment, again, choosing and then returning back to the space of the mind. Is this how you ultimately kind of live this practice?
Very good. You know, I love the question. And once again, a very rich question. So I'm not going to give a sound bite or kind of a bullet in response, give you a bit more, something richer. When we're attending to the space of the body, one reason I don't choose the translation observe the body in the body, I don't think that's what we should be doing. As it, not only that I think it's grammatically not really spot on, I don't think that's a good practice, to observe the body in the body. My translation was, as you might recall, observe the body as the body, right? And not, and that was without all the other junk we pile on top of it, right? And so I'm content with that. But now, okay, so that's a translator's deal. So maybe I'm wrong, but I'll stand by this until shown otherwise. But another reason I will not translate this, or I won't practice it, observe the body in the body, because I find it more useful to observe the subspace of the body, because after all, it's a subspace. There's a visual space, the auditory, and so forth. This is one of many spaces, right? So observe the subspace of the body from the space of awareness. In other words, from a larger space that's not inside, that's loose, and illuminating the subspace of the body, but not caught up in its entrails, not entangled in it, loose, spacious, and this really, the rubber really hits the road, maybe it's an American vernacularism, when it's standing in the space of the mind. The thoughts, the images, the impulses, and all that kind of stuff, don't observe it from inside the mind. It's awfully crowded in there. And you're getting a thought here, and an image comes in here, and an emotion comes in here. It's kind of like being in a crowded subway. You're just getting jostled all over the place if you're inside the mind. Why don't you observe the space of the mind, the subspace of the mind from the space of awareness? Subspace of awareness. And this was the instruction in settling the mind. Let your body be still like a mountain, your awareness still like space. So of course it's a metaphor, but metaphors can be very useful. So having that sense that I'm going to observe a local domain of my mind, and I'm going to be observing that from a much more spacious domain with no edges to it, and that's a space of awareness. And I'm going to observe what takes place in that, and I'm going to rest in stillness in the space of my awareness, observing the comings and goings in that television or that three-dimensional holographic display of my mind, come, go, come, go, come, go, and I'm just resting out here in a larger space, still and unmoved, not getting caught up in the drama. Okay? So there's the feel of it. Now, that's just in private meditation, but you're talking about social interaction. This is really rich. I really love this stuff. Really love this stuff. Let's go back to Martin Buber. This is going to be my interpretation. The first two, I'm on safe ground. The I-it relationship. Okay? So we know what that is. You're my customer, and I want your money. So, hey, hi, Mr. Hodges. What can I do? Good to see you again. I'm so glad. Tell me about your how's the wife? How's the kids? Your business going well? I'm buttering you up because I want your money. You know? You're just a client. And so there you are. You may as well be just an it. So we know about that. And then here's my friend. We've known each other for a year or so. We've corresponded by email. And so, yeah, I got it. You're another human being. I figured that one out. So I'm now attending to you as a fellow human being. Another one. Not this one, but actually another one. An I-you relationship. I'm really taking that into account. And I'm considering your well-being as just as important as my own. So it would be inhuman, degrading, dehumanizing, disgusting, to use you for me. That's just not right. There's no justification for that. It's just not right. It's not realistic. It's not right. So I just know I have to tend to you as you. And if we do things in common because we have a shared vision, there's nothing wrong with that. Or if I want to sell you something and you want to buy it, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that either. But there's the IU relationship, subject to subject, right? And that's called the I-you relationship. So it's I-it, I-you. Those I'm on firm ground. And here's my interpretation, I think it actually might be correct, of the I-thou relation. And the I-thou relation is more of a systems awareness. It's not polarized, I'm way over here and you're way over there. Hello, sentient being. Hello, subject over there. How are you over there? Where it's polarized. And there's a conventional truth to that, of course. You are over there, I'm over here. You can die, I can remain alive, vice versa. But this I-thou relationship, in my understanding of it, is more of a systems of awareness, kind of a global awareness that's encompassing the both of us simultaneously, a systems awareness. So internally, externally, internally and externally, that business, right? So there's more of a less of a polarized, a reification of myself as a subject over here, therefore a release of the reification of you absolutely over there, two fists, now loose. You are rising from moment to moment, me arising from moment to moment, totally entangled in this system we call a conversation or human relationship. But it's more of a global awareness. It's embracing the two simultaneously. Right? Now, in a system's awareness then, if my object is not just you as a person or you as an it for me to manipulate, but if the object of mindfulness is the system, the interrelationship, the entanglement, the whole system, then it's not really polarized, even though my eyeballs, of course, are here. My mental awareness doesn't have to be over here. It's not located inside my head or inside my eyeballs. Mental awareness can be more non-local. It can be taking in the whole system. And taking in the whole system, it's not only attending to this component of the system, this component of the system, but also being aware of thoughts arising, desires arising, emotions arising, memories arising, and so forth and so on. So it's taking in the system not only of your body and my body, but the Buddha said attentive feelings, mental states internally, externally, internally, and externally. And of course, as you and I are still in conversation, I'm monologuing right now, obviously, there is an entanglement there of my mental states arising and your mental states arising in response to that. And some of them I can surmise by your nodding, facial expressions, and so forth, and by what you say next. So in this regard, then, we can say this is more of a global awareness that includes thoughts, memories, desires, emotions, and so forth arising within the system. Because it's an inclusive, more global kind of awareness of the whole thing. It's a very ecological approach, an ecological approach to human interaction. It's really quite elegant. Right? Now, to look at it from another side, according to kind of standard Buddhist psychology within the Indo-Tibetan tradition, we have on the order of magnitude about 600 pulses of cognition per second, right? But 1/600 of a second is generally just too short to ascertain anything. But by the time you get to about 30, 40, 50 milliseconds, they cluster, they bond. And so if you get an impression that lasts for 50 milliseconds or 1/20th of a second, you may actually ascertain it. Okay? Yeah, clear? So in other words, in 1 second, I could, in principle, ascertain 20 things. Because if it takes 50 milliseconds to get enough to cluster together, they actually get something. Well, put 50 into a second, into 1,000. That's 20 things I can know in 1 second. And so this is what mental awareness does. It very rapidly moves from sound to visual to the tactile, to the mental, to you, to me, to the surrounding environment, and so forth. It moves so swiftly. And then it blends them into a coherent, smooth flow that we call life, with a certain blurring activity, like in a motion picture where you're getting 35 frames per second. And so in this regard, we are moving back and forth very rapidly. But again, as we become, and you use the word, become more adept, you can have a sense of not being jolted, jarred, gyrating all over the place like a spastic, you know, like that, the mind just going all over the place, but moving quite fluidly around and weaving. You're weaving into an ongoing flow of a coherent continuum. That could be pretty cool. Okay? Interesting question. Okay, back to another written one. Doing fine for time. Here's from Monica. Where's Monica sitting? I know what you look like. Where's Monica? There you are, thank you. As far as I know, the Prasangika Madhyamikas reject the existence of Alaya Vijnana, which, on the other hand, is proclaimed by the Chittamatra philosophy. When you use the term Alaya Vijnana, or substrate consciousness, do you refer to this very idea, which is rejected by the Prasangikas and assumed by the Chittamatra, or to what else? Very good. Let's get take care of that one. It's a very perfectly good question. As you well know, I was trained, I think you probably know, I was trained for about 20 years in the Gelugpa tradition, and I never left. I never said, boy, I've outgrown that now. Never happened. Never happened. Last 22 years, primarily Dzogchen. But my root lama for all of that time is His Holiness Dalai Lama. And he's an absolutely Prasangika Madhyamika, also very committed to Dzogchen, practices it, teaches it, gives empowerments, and utterly devotee of Tsongkhapa. And I'm the Dalai Lama's student. that's me, Dalai Lama's student. Because I just find it an impeccable combination, an incredible combination. So, am I embracing, when I use this term, Alaya Vijnana, substrate consciousness, am I then how do you say, pushing against the Dalai Lama or Tsongkhapa or Chantakirti, Shantideva. These are the people I'm citing all the time. Am I really rejecting them? You probably figured out I'm not. But then how does that work? And the answer is, it's very important for everybody who's interested in Buddhist philosophy, that what I'm offering here is, I would say, actually totally coherent within the Buddhist framework. Totally coherent. And I'm following in the footsteps of His Holiness Dalai Lama, who teaches Dzogchen and teaches Prasangika Madhyamaka, and Tsongkhapa himself saying, when he was introduced to Dzogchen, it's perfect and complete. So he didn't refute. So if you find contemporary Gelugpa Geshes who said, oh, Dzogchen, mushy thinking, we don't like that, that's no good, fine, you've just refuted Tsongkhapa. Now, how much of a Gelugpa are you now that you've just stomped on Tsongkhapa's foot? You know, that, and I can show you the source. I didn't make that one up. And he received initiation. He received oral transmission on Dzogchen, the whole thing. Quite interesting. So, but now how do we get out of the conundrum? When the term Alaya Vijnana is used in the Chittamatra system, it gets elaborated. Number one, it's reified, it's inherently existent. And number two, it's got all the, and there are whole big fat texts on Alaya Vijnana in the Chittamatra system. So there's a lot of philosophical embroidery, enrichment, additions. It's really thick. It's theoretically very, very thick. And that's exactly what the Prasangika Madhyamikas are refuting. I'm not going there. I haven't even read the Chittamatra presentations of Alaya Vijnana for probably about 30 years. All of my references to Alaya Vijnana are all coming from Dzogchen. And in Dzogchen, they don't even refer to Chittamatra. They use the same term. But and overwhelmingly, when I'm using the term, I'm drawing from the mind treasures of Dujum Lingba. Mind treasures of Dujum Lingba. Now, I've translated, I think now, all of his mind treasures on Dzogchen. It's about 1,000 pages of material. I think I've translated all of it by now. And they'll gradually be published over the next couple of years. So with my Gelugpa training, and I've had superb teachers, really, really good teachers, the list goes on, but Geshe Rabdin, His Holiness, and so forth, I think I have something of a handle of what Prasangika Madhyamika says and what they're refuting. I've also now translated, I've studied carefully, I've received extensive teachings on Vipassana and the teachings on emptiness and dependent origination in Dzogchen by Dujun Lingpa. I see not a trace of anything that's incompatible with Prasangika Madhyamika. Nothing. It's just, boom, right there. Prasangika Madhyamika. Absolutely. And if His Holiness thought that was incompatible, I don't think he'd teach Dzogchen, because his commitment to Prasangika Madhya is so deep, not just theoretically, but I think experientially, it's so deep. I think he would just skip Dzogchen if he felt its teachings on emptiness were somehow incompatible with what he already knows to be true. Well, of course, he's not skipped that. So this is the short answer is that every single one of my references to substrate, the alaya, substrate consciousness, alaya vijnana, are all coming only from Dzogchen, and they don't fall into any of the pitfalls that the Chittamatra do. They don't reify it. They don't add on all that philosophical baggage. It's purely phenomenological. They say, if you practice shamatha, this is what you experience. That's it. They just keep it clean. I haven't seen any metaphysical baggage that they throw on top of it that the prasanga would say, wait a minute, we need to scrape that off. Not any at all. So here's what I would say, and I'll stand by it. And that is the Dzogchen, and I'm relying on Dujum Lingpa. I can't speak for all Dzogchen teachers throughout history. But Dujum Lingpa is classic. He's really, really classic. He speaks with enormous authority. And I would say that everything he says about Alaya and Alaya Vijnana is completely compatible with Prasangika Madhyamika. And it's entirely phenomenological, and there's just nothing to refute. That's it. That's what happens, you know? If you stick your finger into a fire, it's hot. What part of that do you want to refute? You know, that's what happens. And if you achieve shamatha, that's what happens. It's not a philosophical position. It's just, this is what happens. And this is our best description. Wow, it hurts. You know? That's the fire and shamatha, it feels good. Okay. So that, very good question. And now we've got that one cleared out, so then I'll continue to use it freely, the Alaya Vijnana. From the Dzogchen perspective, which is not the same as the last. So now was that was Oh, that was it. So now we're back to the floor. That was too written. Anything that was on the right, anything coming up? Right hemisphere? Okay, but yes, go with you, Daniel. Coming.
A very quick question. When we're settling the mind in his natural state, and we notice that many thoughts that comes by are driven by grasping, what we should do about them? Like,
when you see that many thoughts are arising driven by grasping?
Yes, like this mental connection between images?
Sure. It's called rumination, And what to do, and this is straight from the Dzogchen tradition, from Lerap Lingba and others, is the first thing to do is see if you can just loosen up. Loosen up, because the grasping and then the associations, this leading to this, leading to this, this all comes out of grasping. And if this is the mudra for grasping, this is the mudra for not grasping. Just loosening up. So that's the first thing, is don't fight it, don't resist it, don't not like it. It's a core theme. It's a very, very core theme. And it's hard to learn. But when you're practicing settling the mind in its natural state, not to experience aversion to having a lot of thoughts. And if you've done a lot of mindfulness of breathing or other types of shamatha practice, like focusing on a Buddha image and so forth, you don't want a lot of thoughts. You'd like as few as possible. And then you say, the practice went very well. My mind was really quiet. Fair enough, it's good. But when you're doing settling the mind in its natural state, then you really have to stop preferring to have a quiet mind versus a busy mind. If you prefer it, you are grasping, which means you're not doing the practice correctly. You're suppressing thoughts because you don't want them. Right? So this means you need to be totally at ease and even. This is why this is something of a precursor to actual Dzogchen meditation, to realize the one taste of samsara and nirvana. It's hard to imagining it. That if you could actually have a taste of nirvana, and then you have a taste of the whole realm, six realms of samsara, you would actually have no preference. How would you not have preference for immutable bliss over samsara? Well, how that's possible is you're ascertaining both from a perspective that's deeper than both, and from that perspective, they are of one taste. There is no preference. From the perspective of Rigpa, nirvana is no more preferable, desirable, than hell realms. There is a perspective from which that's true. Now, if you're not there, it's a no-brainer. Of course, we don't, let alone hell realms, we don't want to have a cold. We don't want to have sniffles. I'd rather have nirvana than have the sniffles. You know? But that means you haven't realized Rigpa. So I must say, I'm quite skeptical when, you know, people nowadays, my Rigpa this, my experience with Rigpa that. I said, really? You've realized Rigpa, have you? One of the little tests. I've never had the test. But it's sometimes done. Not rarely now, because it's probably the, illegal. In Tibet, very very little was illegal. They didn't have policemen. That's just for starters. You know, that makes things a lot looser. But I've heard in some Dzogchen empowerments, they'll have a plate with some very nice food on it and a plate of shit. One taste of samsara? Do you have any preference? If you do, then you're not viewing it from a perspective of Rigpa. I have to tell another story. The incarnation of the father of one of my lamas. My lama has passed away years ago. Senshap Sekon Rinpoche. Some of you from Dharamsala old days, remember him? Sekon Rinpoche. They're right there, just off of McLeod Ganj. He was one of my lamas, wonderful lamas, incredibly sweet, gentle, just one sweet lama. His dad was outrageous. He was a Mahasiddha. Sekon Dorje Chang, he called him. And Sekon Rinpoche told me, this is in the early 70s, Sekon Rinpoche was one of the grand old lamas. He was in his 70s. He was one of the secondary tutors of the Dalai Lama. He's just one of the grand lamas. You know, his dad was a Mahasiddha. And Sekon Rinpoche said that when he was a boy, and his father wanted to entertain him, you know, dads like to entertain the kids, his dad would take some sampa, parched barley meal, and get it together with some, you know, Tibetan butter, mold it into shapes of little like gingerbread men, but made out of sampa, and then have them dance. And his son would, "Do it again, Daddy." You know, that's what you get when you have a mazeta for a dad. So his father passed away years ago. Born in Nepal, and there he was called Serkon Dorje Chang. Dorje Chang means Vajradhara, Serkon. It's an incarnation of my lama's dad. He lived in Nepal. He's passed away now, but not a long time ago. And he was known as just being, this is back in the 1970s or so, not that long ago. But he was known as just one of those incredibly deep and totally wild, unpredictable, spontaneous yogis. But not one of the phony baloney ones that we've had recently. You know, "Oh, I'm having sex with all the women because I'm practicing crazy wisdom." This was real. He has crazy wisdom, but it was really wisdom. And he was a layperson. Still, of course, great, great yogi, living there in the Kathmandu area. And he would drink sometimes. And he had monastic disciples. And one of his monastic disciples, when they're out walking, wanted to give his guru a little bit of advice. Oh, it's a very bold thing to do when your guru is a mahasiddha. And he said, "You know, Lamala, Lamaji, you know, you're drinking, you're not setting a very good example for the monks. Maybe you could cool it with the drinking, you know. I mean, the Buddha said you shouldn't even drink a drop of alcohol. Maybe you could cool it with the drinking. Wouldn't that be a good idea?" And they're walking along the streets of Kathmandu, maybe about 40 years ago. And anybody who knows Kathmandu, so imagine this. Imagine it vividly. He's got his mug with him. They'd often travel with the mug in the jola. He takes his mug and he sloops it down into the gutter in downtown Kathmandu. Sloops it down, gets some gutter water. And then he goes, drinks it. And then he turns it to his monastic disciple and said, "Your turn." And the real good part of the story is he didn't die. Because there would have been cholera in there, probably hepatitis in there. Who knows what would it? I mean, any one of a dozen things would have killed him from what cup, you know. No, he just transformed it. One taste of samsara nirvana. Okay? That was a tangent from something that I have no idea what was. Anybody remember the question? Where did it come from anyway? The question was? It's a good story, though, eh? Go ahead, Daniel. I'm going to connect it. I'm going to I'm going to connect the dots. I'm going to do it right now as soon as you speak. Battery dead?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was about grasping in thoughts.
And grasping at... So having no preference for a mango lassi versus Kathmandu gutter water. Same taste from the perspective of Rigpa. Well, that's real Dzogchen. That's real Dzogchen. If you have one taste between Kathmandu gutter water and a mango lassi, then from that perspective, number one, neither one will make you sick because you just transmute them. But they actually are, you have no preference. No preference. That's real Dzogchen meditation. The deepest hell realms to the pure lands. No preference. Because you're seeing it from a ground that's deeper than both. And that's a primordially pure ground. Now, how do I connecting the dots? That's Dzogchen meditation. Resting in Rigpa is that resting in that perspective and not just sitting like a marmot. I'm practicing open presence. Don't pinch me. Oh, mosquitoes, I hate mosquitoes. Rigpa, I love Rigpa. Don't like that mosquito either. Silly. So settling the mind in its natural state is a prelude for that. It's a shamatha mundo. For real Dzogchen, because there it is, and this is where I'm connecting the dots. Lots of thoughts, few thoughts. Nasty thoughts, lovely thoughts. Virtuous thoughts, non-virtuous thoughts. you're viewing it, you're doing your best to view it from the perspective of substrate consciousness, without any grasping onto any of them, which means that if you're approximating the perspective of substrate consciousness as a prelude to viewing them from the perspective of Rigpa, which in which case they all manifest as displays of primordial consciousness, right? So anger is simply displaying itself as mirror-like primordial consciousness. Craving arises, and it's displaying itself as the mirror-like, you know, wisdom of discernment, discerning, you know, sosotopa yeshe. So primordial consciousness of discernment. But they're actually displaying themselves. What other people see as mental afflictions, for you, from your perspective of Rigpa, you're seeing them as displays of primordial consciousness. Right? Why? That's your perspective. Well, we're not there yet, unless you're a Dzogchen accomplished Dzogchen practitioner. But we're doing a facsimile of that. We're tapping into our best approximation of substrate consciousness so that even though we don't see thoughts of anger, craving, and so forth as primordial consciousness, at most we're just imagining that as in state regeneration. Okay, but that's imagination. We're not imagining anything in settling the mind in its natural state, but viewing them without grasping. And even if an afflictive thought arises, a mental affliction arises, they don't afflict. They don't afflict. It's like a smallpox virus in a sealed vial, in a sealed jar. It doesn't harm because it's in a sealed jar. Right? If it got out, it would wreak havoc. It would create great misery. But it's not, and therefore it's not toxic in the jar. It's just a virus, just sitting there minding its own business. No problem. Just don't let it out of the jar. Right? And so likewise, mental afflictions, when they're in the jar of your space of your mind, and you're viewing them from the space of awareness, and you're not letting them out and contaminating your awareness, they do not afflict. Therefore, they are not mental afflictions. Therefore, there's no reason to try to get rid of them. So that's the challenge here. Whether your mind is very busy, or it's loose, or very vacuous, the idea here is a facsimile of actual Dzogchen meditation. You with one taste. No thoughts, whatever. Few thoughts, whatever. Many thoughts, whatever. But you can say that if and only if you're attending to them without grasping. And without grasping means also without preference. Okay? And in that way, by not riling them up, arousing them, aggravating, exacerbating them, by the grasping, I hope, I fear, I like, I don't like, that keeps on getting them to keep on churning. If you maintain with continuity this quality of luminous, clear, discerning, but non-reactive, not labeling, not grasping awareness, it's in that way that your mind, while you're attending to it lucidly, your mind will dissolve. It will dissolve gradually. It will melt, and your mind will dissolve into substrate consciousness. But as long as you still care, you're hoping, you're fearing, you're anticipating, you're grasping and preferring, that'll keep it going. And why? Because you're viewing your psyche from inside the psyche. And that's just called samsara. I like this thought, I don't like that thought. But the more you can rest in stillness, in the space of your awareness, in a larger space, then the energy of the turbulence of the mind gradually subsides, and it's as if you're falling asleep lucidly and watching yourself lose your mind. And you'll retrieve it. It'll come back. Okay? Very good. And now I'll do one more here from Jochen. There's Jochen. In one of the previous sessions, you quoted Chandadeva's 9th chapter as saying that there is nothing whatsoever that does not become easier through familiarization. A 6th chapter, patience chapter. A 9th chapter is a wisdom chapter. Okay. In my experience, getting familiar with the meditation practice also entails the risk of becoming inattentive, sloppy towards the practice. Rather than knowing what I'm doing during the practice, it may become routine work. How can we find a balance between knowingly performing the familiar practice and preserving a fresh and unbiased beginner's mind? Another very good question. All of these are really spot on. What you're pointing to is a very well-known and a very important psychological truth. And that is when we're freshly mastering a skill, like learning how to drive standard transmission, play ping pong, whatever it is, table tennis, you know, whatever it is, a new skill, it calls for our attention. It's effortful. sometimes a bit strenuous, maybe a bit anxious, like riding stick shift and so forth. And then so many scientific studies have showed this, I don't think they need to show it anymore, everybody knows, that as we become very familiar with something, then it just generally goes on autopilot and we have less and less attention to it, awareness of it. And so riding a bicycle, are you really aware of where your left foot is, and are you really aware of keeping balance and so forth? Probably not. You don't need to, so why should you give attention to that when it's no longer needed? And likewise, a rather complex set of motor actions of driving standard transmission, it's not that easy, but once you become familiar with it, it is easy, in which case you could be having be caught in an argument. I mean, really, a lot of attention going to the person in the passenger seat, and still, yeah, I don't believe so, yeah, blah, 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 and still do everything you need to do there unconsciously and perfectly. So that's the tendency, that when we become very familiar with something, habituated is the word they use, it becomes unconscious. So some of you, I think rather a number of you, have taken tantric empowerment. So you have daily commitments, which means you have certain things you need to recite every day. Need I say more? You know, I mean, I memorized my sadhanas 35 years ago, you know, and they just flow. So I'm habituated to them, and it's very easy just to have them flow right on through. And don't mind me, I'm not here. Good, one more commitment, done. So that is, and to quote Shantideva again, where is this one? I think it's in maybe 8th chapter. I think it is 8th chapter. No, maybe it's not. Fifth chapter. He said, oral recitations that are done with a wandering mind are meaningless. Fifth chapter. Pointless. De mais. No point. Zero value. Blah, 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 blah. Mind not engaged. Who do you think you're fooling here? You think... But they think the Buddhists are saying, oh boy, she did it again. Thank goodness you gave me a mindless recitation. That really makes my day. Who are you fooling? The Lama, yourself, the Buddhas? By just going through some charade, some cheap imitation of Dharma practice? You think somebody really getting fooled here? That's keeping a commitment? I vow from now on to waste my time at least 1 hour every day engaging in pointless, mindless ritual activity. You have my word on it. And the Buddha's just, oh boy, we have another convert. Great. This is one reason why I give so little ritual in the teachings I'm giving, that if we have a ritual, at least that's, you can't, your mind can't wander that much. I'm going to die. You know? Okay, got it. So there's the answer. But the question still needs an answer. Well, of course, the thing that the mind, in a way, here's this the prime directive, is we care, we want to find happiness, we want to be happy, we don't want to suffer. And if you're doing a sadhana, or you're doing mindfulness breathing, or doing pretty much any of the practice we're doing here, and you're not finding it engaging, it's a nice English phrasing. You're not finding it engaging. It's not particularly interesting. It's not particularly satisfying. You don't find it meaningful. Then your mind will wander off. It will find something else more entertaining. Even if it's a dead, boring rumination of something you've already thought about 30 times. The mind says, well, better than what you had. You're just breathing in and breathing out. This is more interesting. Grocery list. What will be the dessert for the evening's meal? You know? So, but it's because it's not engaging. Well, why is it not engaging? Lack of clarity. So there has to be an appeal. To be speak really in a very blunt way, there has to be some appeal to the practice. And if there isn't, then we'll either stop doing it or we'll just go through the motions for whatever reason. We fear Vajra hell, or wonder what the hell am I doing here anyway, may as well do it, you know, whatever. So it has to have some appeal. It has to engage us in some way. Now, William James wrote brilliantly about attention in a number of ways, and he spoke about this. It's very relevant. He was speaking, I think, in the context of education. To my mind, learning, when I was a kid, learning spelling, just having to memorize a whole bunch of words, in German is rather easy, because it's so phonetic, but English is not easy. There's just so many weird spellings for all kinds of things. But German, it's pretty, you hear it, you can almost spell it, you know, right? But English, it's a pain. It's just so many words you have to memorize, individual, as you have to memorize die, karissa, die, der, or das. Why is it das Kind? Why are kids neuter? I mean, really. So there it is. Because they haven't gotten a gender yet? I don't know, you know. But it would be difficult, as you well know. You can't always guess what the gender is going to be of a noun. You can't always guess. Sometimes, yeah, maybe, die Frau. That's pretty easy. But then a lot of other ones are not. So there, you just have to memorize it verbatim, right? And it's not interesting. But a student wanting to get good grades will say, that's not interesting, but I really would like to get good grades. I'd like to get good grades, because then that will open up this, my parents will be pleased, I'll get this, and this will open up that opportunity, and that will open up that opportunity, and then they'll be pleased. And so, because I'm interested in those things, therefore I'm interested in learning die, der, das, or I'm learning English spelling. So I don't look like an idiot. I don't grow into adulthood and still not know how to spell and look like I'm an uneducated idiot. You know. Now you can get by with spell check on computers nowadays. But there is, so what he's saying is the level of interest may be higher than the actual activity itself. And it may be very strong, which then engages you, so you really do learn the spelling of all those words, thousands of words, you do learn it. Not because they're interesting, but because you'd like to be an educated person and know how to write good English and be able to read well. Okay? So it's a higher level of interest. So likewise for shamatha, mindfulness of breathing. When you're a beginner at it, before the clarity starts kicking in, it can be boring. For many people, there's a boring phase, a boring spell, where at the beginning it's not boring because your mind is gyrating all over the place, so you can't be on it long enough to get bored, right? It's just dealing with rumination after rumination. Say, okay. And then you get into the flow. You get a bit of continuity of attention. And as soon as you get there, then getting into stage four or so, then you can become complacent because you're bored. And it comes right back to the issue of habituation, and that is now you can go mindless, and then you can gradually slip into a stupor, because it's not interesting, but it's not troubling, and you just kind of slip into it. So, what's the antidote? One way or another, find the practice interesting. So you may not be interested in the tactile sensations themselves, but are you interested in developing the qualities of relaxation, stability, and vividness in the mind? Do you think that would be a good thing? Could it serve you well for the rest of your life? If so, this is a pretty darn good technique. So take an interest in the technique, because this is shamatha, and shamatha is really important for all these reasons, mundane and supramundane. So you can have a meta level. So if there's a point at which, like learning spelling of English words, it's just not interesting, but after a while you just get good at it, and then you've mastered it. Likewise, or actually somewhat different, in mindfulness of breathing, you may get to a boring spell, but then as you start to pay closer attention, the vividness starts coming up. And as Danny, where's Danny? Danny Morris. Where's Danny Morris? They're way over there now. So as Danny Morris says, his nice one-page account of when the breath goes subtle, then it gets interesting, doesn't it? It's not boring. Number one, you don't know how it's going to turn out, but there's a flow there. It's rather pleasant, at least very calm, and you don't really want to wander. And if rumination comes up, it just kind of tends to be more peripheral but not dragging you off, because you'd really rather stay here, right? And whether you'd call it interesting, it's engaging. There's a really good word. It's engaging, and you don't want to wander off, and you don't get dopey. You don't go like that, because then it's not as interesting anymore. So whatever it is, the solution, one way, we have to be clever. Whether we're working at a higher level of interest or a level of interest right in it, settling the mind in its natural state can be actually pretty easy access, in the sense that what's arising can be really quite interesting, and you never know what's coming up. After the in-breath, you know what's coming up. And after the out-breath, you probably know what's coming up. but not forever. You might be surprised. It just died. Oh, surprise. That can happen. So that's the answer. That's the answer. It's the level of engagement. And that goes for sadhanas as well. When you've done sadhanas, and a number of us here have, it is really pretty easy to just go on an autopilot and just get them done and say, okay, finish that. But my response to that is, if you've got a commitment and you're keeping it, you might as well make it interesting. Because you're giving the time to it anyway. So why have it be boring? Why just get through it? When you could pay attention to it, I mean, that's what actually is going on. So why not? Why not? Because there's nothing better to do. And so why not just pay more attention? Then it does get more interesting. And then you feel, okay, well, this is actually what the Lama intended, and not that I went through a mindless ritual. So if you have a bit of shamatha beforehand, and the mind does get composed and focused, and then you go into the more active routine, maybe the mudras, the mantras, the visualization, all of that, if your mind already is somewhat composed and relaxed, then you can bring that serviceable mind into your sadhana, your mantra recitation, and so forth, and it will be more satisfying. It just is. Because there's just nothing satisfying about empty rituals. And I don't care whether it's a Christian ritual like Mass, whether it's reciting a Chenrezi sadhana, or whether it's a ritual of going to the stock market and making more money. It's just one more ritual. That's a ritual of success. Honey, I'm home, made $10,000 today. Nice. But it can be just utterly, because there was never anything behind it. It can really happen. It was just a symbol. It was numbers. It was zeros. A different, and the money in your account just changed. Empty ritual. Or you drive home in your $300,000 Porsche. Hi, honey, I'm home. Still just a car. Great big symbol. Look how successful I am. Look what an incredible machine I drive. But when all is said and done, it's just transportation. You can see what a good advertising agent I would be for Porsches. And all is said and done, it gets you from here to there. but that's actually it. Or the Dalai Lama says, in terms of these fabulously wealthy people who have like 100-room houses, mansions and all of that, he said, how many rooms can you be in at one time? And how many meals can you eat each day? And he said, that's it. You're a beggar or you're a rich person. You're still in only one room at a time. You can only eat so many meals per day. They should start going the Roman method, And besides all of that, my meal costs $500, his meal costs 50 cents. He may enjoy that meal just as much as you're enjoying your super-duper gourmet meal. In terms of actual enjoyment, person chowing down a nice, dal and rice. Dal and rice can be pretty darn good. I've really enjoyed dal and rice in my time. Right? Just as much as a $300 meal. So when all is said and done, empty rituals are that. Empty. So, that's it. Enjoy your day. See you tomorrow morning.